Today we are having the opportunity to hear two gentlemen well trained in their fields discuss one of the most important subjects which has come before us in a long time, a subject which it is hoped the public of this state will consider extremely seriously at the coming election. The debate is to be between Dr. Richardson, Dr. Ralph Richardson, former president of the Los Angeles Board of Education, and Dr. Maxwell Rafferty, superintendent of schools at La Cañada. And for the benefit of those who live north of the Tehachapi, La Cañada is just out of Los Angeles. I make that statement because I happen to have had somebody who was very close to me here ask Dr. Rafferty where that was a little while ago, and he explained it to him, and I'm passing this information on to you. I'm in the position of a judge today. This is a debate, and it's long been my view that a judge does well when he says very little and keeps his mouth closed. I've operated on the theory that it's much better for the lawyers and the audience to think that the judge is stupid rather than for him to ask questions and remove any doubt about it. There will be 13 minutes on either side and then the usual question period. That raised the problem of which one of the speakers should be first. And we decided that this being Northern California, it would be all right to determine that by gambling. The head of the coin, which I hold in my hand, represents Dr. Richardson. The reverse side which is the Liberty Bell represents Dr. Rafferty. I'm going to ask our president, Hillary Crawford, to tell me what the coin is.
Liberty Bell.
Our first speaker will be Dr. Maxwell Rafferty. Dr. Rafferty.
It struck both my opponent and myself simultaneously there that the Liberty Bell, as is well known, is somewhat cracked. I question whether I got any advantage out of that introduction after all. Wonderful to be here with you today. Something that a humble schoolman looks forward to and never expects to consummate in his whole life. And I deeply appreciate the chance to be with you. The great issue in California schools is whether we've let this thing called progressive education entrench itself so deeply in our professional leadership that we may not be able to pluck it out. So many of our school people, for so many years, have been told that John Dewey's peculiar version of pragmatism is the only legitimate philosophy of education extant, but a very large number of them have actually come to believe it. They really believe that the principal goal of education should be the happy, peaceful, comfortable adjustment of the child to his environment. They feel that things like togetherness and in-groupness and democratic socializing are more important than learning to use the intellectual tools which the race over the centuries has found to be indispensable. They are convinced that once the child has become an adjusted, accepted, adapted member of his peer group, that the main job of the school has been done. I disagree. You see, about a generation ago, John Dewey's utilitarianism began to permeate the nation's educational thinking. Some of it, such as his emphasis on problem solving, was of great value. But the underlying theory was not only wrong, as applied to children, it was positively dangerous. Pragmatism is the only philosophy without a metaphysics. It acknowledges no eternal truths, no universal verities, no lasting values. Life to the pragmatist is a vortex of constant change, a whirling state of flux, a vast kaleidoscope. Under such a philosophy, it follows that the only thing worth teaching children is the ability to adapt readily to a constantly shifting environment. It's the credo of the man on the roller coaster who never sees the same view twice. It's a way of thinking and of teaching, which I reject generally and categorically. Certainly the schools must concern themselves with the child's adaptation to his surroundings, to his perception of his role in the world. But other agencies than the schools help shape him in these areas. The home, the church, society itself all play vital roles in educating the whole child, as we call it. What the school has uniquely to offer is subject matter, systematically organized and vividly and interestingly presented. No other social agency is able to perform this vital function. No other even tries. It's in this crucial role that California's state philosophy of education has been found wanting. According to the statistics of the United States Armed Forces Institute, as reported by our own State Department of Education, we have fallen in two decades as a state from 5th in the nation to 35th in the quality of our educational product. We have turned out far too many high school graduates who cannot spell the simplest words, who have never learned the alphabet, and who have never been required to master the multiplication tables. We have banished Charlemagne and Caesar, Napoleon and Nelson from our elementary curriculum, and we have denied the children their proper birthright, friendship with the wonderful heroes of childhood, Ivanhoe and Hiawatha, Jim Hawkins and Alice in Wonderland, Huck Finn and the Three Musketeers. We have failed utterly to introduce even the basic elements of economics into the state course of study, with the result that thousands of California young people go out into the world each year with as little knowledge of how this nation got here economically as they have of Etruscan tomb carvings. This outcome was inevitable, given an official California philosophy of education, which held that subject matter should be an outcome of life adjustment education, rather than the other way around. It was supremely ironical that while we educators were talking so loudly about preparing the child for life, we were simultaneously downgrading subject matter, the knowledge and mastery of which are the only things which stand today between the United States of America and atomized destruction. Life itself in the second half of the 20th century depends upon subject matter, and we'd better start teaching it more carefully and more intensively and more devotedly than ever before in our history. I propose to lead a change in our way of thinking about education in this state. I say openly and clearly to you all that the schools exist primarily to teach subject matter, that one of our great functions as educators is to hand down from generation to generation the shining artifacts of our cultural heritage, forged for us with such infinite pains by the giants of the past. And I say to you that discipline and courtesy and respect for one's elders are necessary prerequisites for the proper mastering of this material. Education, gentlemen, is a serious business. California spends more money on it than does any other state. It's high time we began getting a better return on our investment. There are other issues in California schools this year of 1962, of course. One of these is how we're going to pay for the educating of a constantly growing army of children. In 1950, the state paid roughly half the bill for local education. Today, it pays, according to some estimates, only about 38 or 39%. This means that within 12 years, local real property taxpayers have had to shoulder a 12% greater load, and the state has shifted out from under the same percentage. One of the most important duties of your new state superintendent of schools will be to try to persuade the state to assume, once again, the principle of parity in local school financing. Another issue is the question of exactly who is going to control California's schools. For the past 10 years, we've watched a consistent erosion of local control by locally elected school boards in favor of an equally consistent aggrandizement of state power over the affairs of local districts. I submit that this is a dangerous trend. Throughout our history, the function of the state in education has been the threefold one of research, service, and leadership. Control has traditionally been reserved largely to the local school districts. After my election, I pledge myself to work in many areas and in many ways to reverse this present trend toward statism and to restore our ancient reliance upon local control. Such control is even now being menaced from a new and bewildering direction. A school district in the South has had sanctions applied against it by a privately controlled, privately financed teachers' association, on the grounds that the elected representatives of the people of that district are not running their schools to suit the teachers' association. Now, I'm a teacher and a schoolman of 22 years standing and a lifelong member of this same association. But I say to you that teachers and school administrators like me work for the people and for the people's representatives, not the other way around. We schoolmen do not and should not control your schools. The people do and should. Every school employee, like me, has the American right to try to change things, and once the people have spoken, to quit his job if he still disagrees and go elsewhere if he doesn't like the way the district is being run by the people. But for a privately controlled teachers' group to invoke and to apply sanctions against a legally constituted, freely elected school board is as wrong and as dangerous as it would be for a policeman's association to enforce sanctions against an elected police commission. Surely one of the great issues before us today also is the nature of the office of the State Superintendency of Public Instruction. It deals with the curriculum of California's schools, with the content and format of the textbooks used by millions of our children, with credentialing of teachers, with schoolhouse planning and construction, with budgets and their construction, with equalization formulas of varying degrees of complexity, and 100 other purely administrative functions. It allocates billions of our tax dollars. Virtually every group or survey team which has studied this question has stated that the necessary prerequisites for this high office should be the California teaching credential, the California administrative credential, California administrative and teaching experience on all levels, and the doctoral degree in school administration. I have all of these things. Here, then, are some of the great issues of California education. They demand the prayerful consideration of all of us, not just the school people alone. Even as war is too important to be left only to the generals, so also is California education far too important to be left solely to the educators. Over the years, our country and our state have embarked upon a unique and far-reaching experiment called Education for All. Of all the countries of the world, we are the only ones to pioneer, first, in this great untapped field with all its incalculable consequences for the future. It's going to be up to all of us in California and in the United States this year to see to it that this great experiment does not become controls over all or propaganda for all, or perhaps most dangerous here in California, pablum for all. This is a job for every single one of us. Unless we tackle it without delay and without flinching, the golden moments of opportunity may be lost forever if we will take the time and the interest which our grandparents took before us, the time and the interest which education in the 20th century deserves and requires. We may yet establish this ancient and wonderful art of mine, the art of teaching, in its rightful place as the great supplier of the motive power in the modern race between civilization and catastrophe. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Rafferty. Now we shall hear from Dr. Ralph Richardson. Dr. Richardson.
Justice McComb and gentlemen, it is a wonderful tribute to the goals and the future of education in California that such a distinguished organization as this would provide us with a forum for the future. It is a tribute to the office that my opponent and I seek. As I lay my candidacy before you this afternoon, I intend to organize it around five subdivisions. I will touch first upon the areas of agreement between my opponent and myself. Second, I will refer to my own background, training, and experience for the office I seek. Third, I will lay before you a great many specific proposals which I would hope to implement upon my election. Fourth, I will turn to the support I have in this campaign. And fifth, I will turn to an analysis of what I believe to be the basic and philosophical differences between my opponent and myself. First, now, the area of agreement. Throughout the course of this campaign, both my opponent and I have publicly stated that we are urging that the populace of California approve Proposition 1A, the necessary measure for the capital outlay for the growth of higher education in California. We are both committed to the belief that there is an urgent need for the state of California, through the broader sources of revenue available to it, to increase its participation in the financing of public education. Here are areas of agreement. There is also an area of agreement, whether my opponent will concede it or not, that we are both dedicated firmly and strongly to a new focus, a new emphasis upon subject matter in our schools. Now, turning second to my own background. I am a native of the Midwest. I attended in Kansas a one-room country school. My wife was a one-room country school teacher, but not, I hasten to add, while I was in attendance. I was educated in the Midwest, taught at Penn State, taught at Northwestern, and since 1948 I've been on the faculty of the University of California as a professor in the Department of English. And let me assure you that as a professor of English, I have been profoundly concerned with the failures of what is popularly called progressive education. And I'm deeply and earnestly committed to any steps and all steps which will lift the level of literacy of this state. And to that objective, toward that goal, I have some suggestions to make in a moment. In addition to my professorship at the university, I have had statewide experience as planning and research secretary to the governor of California, in which capacity I was privileged to participate in some major decisions affecting California education. I had an early and formative role in the establishment of California's nationally honored and nationally recognized Master Plan for Higher Education, the new liaison agency by which we are attempting to coordinate and give direction to the development of higher education in California, the campuses of the state colleges, the university, and the junior colleges. Also, while on the governor's staff, I had a major role in a recommendation which has since become law, broadening the availability of textbooks in California such that we may now purchase directly from private publishers those books we believe to be best. This is my background. Then more specifically, I call your attention to this. For 5.5 years, I have held nonpartisan office as board member or president of the Board of Education of the second largest city in the United States, the largest in California. Here, as an elected official, I have been responsible for policy decisions of our board, working with them, of this magnitude. a budget during my term of presidency, including capital outlay in excess of $400 million, responsible to the public in this capacity. A school enrollment of over 700,000 students, one-fifth of all those attending the public schools of California, and a teaching staff and administrative staff and non-teaching staff of some 45,000. I would like now to say what has been achieved in my home community. I have told you that I'm deeply committed to the importance of subject matter. When I was elected to the Los Angeles Board of Education, nationally standardized achievement tests showed that our high school seniors, taken collectively, ranked in the 73rd percentile nationally. That is not bad when we can assume that 73% of all the high schools in the nation would have been below that of the Los Angeles system. As of today, by the same testing measurements, our high school students in my community are ranking in the 90th percentile. We have achieved and established major improvements in the strengthening of our high school curriculum with a new demand for achievement and excellence in academic preparation, fourth-year support of language courses, new courses in mathematics analysis, new courses in history, new courses in English composition. Requirement for graduation is now in my community 170 high school units instead of the prior 150 units. Also, I'd point out that we have achieved major improvements in strengthening in our elementary school curriculum. We begin now within our district of a new reading program, beginning right in the kindergarten with the basic focus upon phonics as a means of teaching reading, but not, I hasten to assure you, the only means. In our elementary schools of my home community, we call subject matters by their proper and accurate names. We teach United States history. We teach United States geography by those labels, and they appear on our grade cards as such. And further on our grade cards is the standard and, I believe, best system of grading, A, B, C, D, and F. And I have four children in the Los Angeles public schools, and they get a variety of those grades. I am proud that in our community we have a publicly announced and declared policy committing our whole school system to the significance and to the value of homework. And we urge all of our teachers to use this as one of the best means of developing skills and study. I am proud that in my community we've taken forward and far-reaching steps in an attack upon the problem of the dropout student. I am proud of our cooperation with business and industry and our new Southern California Industry Education Council. I am proud of the peace and harmony with respect to racial tensions within our community. So much of my background. Now let me turn to specific proposals. I specifically commit myself, if elected, to go before the legislature and to seek the necessary state financing to work in cooperation with local districts for a crisis program in the area of teaching our children to read. Because of the high mobility of our population, because of the in-migration of a great many thousands of students from the South, where their education has suffered a blight of bigotry, we do have problems in reading in this state. I propose this. Let us establish as a statewide policy this public declaration. We will not allow ourselves the luxury of failure in our responsibility to teach children to read. If a child enters the third grade as a functional non-reader, let us declare a crisis in his education. If need be, interrupt the total curriculum and make teaching him to read the top, the sole priority of our school system. I propose this, that we study the child's reading difficulty in depth. What are the factors of physiological conditioning, vision, hearing, perception? What are the factors of intellectual capacity? What are the cultural and linguistic factors? Let us identify that problem and then work with that child in small classes with competently trained specialists so that at the end of a semester, at the end of a year, having mobilized all of the resources of our community, we have taught that child truly to read or know that it's not the will of Providence that he read. For this proposal, I will specifically ask state funds to be distributed to local districts, not indiscriminately upon the basis of attendance, but upon the basis of clearly established need with respect to the magnitude of the problem of the non-reader. I will also propose a change in state law which will permit us, as we cannot now do, hire and retain outside of the classroom qualified teachers of English to work with our English teachers in the high schools in reading themes, in grading them, in pointing out the errors in spelling and syntax, such that we can establish as a statewide policy in California that a student taking a high school course in English composition will at least write one major theme a week and have that graded and have the mistakes pointed out to him. Now we have to depend too much upon objective testing. As a consequence, while the test gives us some measure of the student's ability to read, it gives us no measure of his ability to write. We learn little about a student if we give him an objective test and say, Hamlet was A Greek, B, a Dane, C, a Dodger, and D, a candidate for superintendent of public instruction. We gain little that way. We must have him write if he's to develop any facility with any felicity and facility with the English language. I propose a major reorganization of the California State Department of Education. I will establish a task force of the best minds in educational administration, the best minds in teacher leadership, the best minds in governmental theory, and consult freely with business and management consultant agencies, seeking a reorganization of the California Department of Education in order that we may improve its curricular leadership, its role of service and function to the local districts. I propose specifically that state approach be changed. Now, in the adoption of basic textbooks in California, if two books are adopted, school districts are compelled to take 50% of one book and 50% of another. There is no local choice in the election of multiple adoptions among state textbooks. I propose to change this and to give to each local district the authority and the right to order in advance its ratio or percentage of one book to another. This, I think, would tremendously strengthen local option. I propose also that some major studies be made in the financing of public education in California. There is, as you know, tremendous inequality in assessment practices throughout California. There is a need for further movement in the direction of school district unification. I am also basically committed philosophically to the belief that a countywide tax partially based upon drawing from property resources is one way of equalizing educational opportunities in California. I will also propose that the Curriculum Commission in California, the 10-member agency, now be enlarged to a larger group to include lay citizens that we might have better sense of the public pulse as we develop curricular matters and as we turn to textbooks. It's upon the basis of proposals such as this, I would hope, and on the basis of my background in Los Angeles, that I am proud to say that my candidacy is endorsed and supported statewide by all of the distinguished educations and distinguished organizations in public education. The California Association of School Administrators, an organization of 1,000 men and women carrying the title of Superintendent of Schools, has endorsed my candidacy by a 10-to-1 vote of its membership. The California Secondary School Administrators, the California Elementary School Administrators, the California Teachers Association. In my home community, I'm endorsed and supported by all the administrative, all the teacher organizations, and all the non-teaching organizations of my community. I am endorsed and supported in this campaign by two former presidents of the Los Angeles Chamber of Commerce, by a former president of the Los Angeles County Medical Association, and by a distinguished group of citizens statewide, including Dr. Joel Hildebrand, whose presence honors me here today. It is upon the basis of this support and the basis of my specific proposals outlined before you and my own background that I now turn to this question. What are the philosophical differences between my opponent and me? As I would see them, as I read my opponent's statement, he seems to be concerned with an education not for all the students, but for the elite. I must protest his language when he describes our children as, quote, slobs and creeps, when he refers to them as spineless characters. I must protest his proposal that we establish a type of schooling for the intellectual elite in this state alone. He has proposed that there be established a new program by which gifted children are taken from their homes and placed in, quote, culturally screened homes, and the program supported by the state. Here is a major difference. There is also a major difference on this theme. I am committed to the value of education, not indoctrination. We have a tremendous history of this nation to teach. We have a formidable threat, a vicious enemy which would subvert our way of life, which would destroy us. But I am convinced that as we teach our children the danger and the threat of communism, that we can do so having basic confidence that the truth is on our side, that our teachers are capable, and that the way of a democracy is education, not indoctrination. I am committed to this, that we desperately need to strengthen our training in the three R's. But the three R's are not all. In addition to teaching our children to read, to write, and to spell, we must also teach them to reason, to think in depth, to have a respect for scientific methods, a scientific learning. We are educating the young men and women for the 21st century, the young men who will live and work then. In closing, may we not demean the office we seek. In all our talk about teachers, taxes, and textbooks, may we not forget that our responsibility is to children. It is to the young men and women of tomorrow that we dedicate ourselves, the young men and women in whose heads, hands, and hearts we place such high hopes. Thank you.
Dr. Richardson, Dr. Rafferty, we thank you very much for your splendid discourse here today. We will now have the question period. presided over by the President of the Commonwealth Club of California, President Hillary Crawford. President Crawford.
This is the last day for Justice Marshall McComb of the Supreme Court as quarterly chairman. He's done a very fine job, and will you join with me in saluting him and thanking him for his services? Very large percentage of our 10,500 members are here. I heard these gentlemen on television last night. It was nice and gentlemanly, but the fur was flying. I can hardly wait till the day when we have two ladies running against each other for this office. Because the first one will probably say, my opponent, I haven't seen her in 20 years, and I didn't realize it till I saw how old she was looking. And the other one will say, I didn't know you at all. I wouldn't have known you if it hadn't been for your hat. And the first one will say, it's a nice suit you have on. It's too bad it didn't have your size. Now we'll plunge right into the... end of the question period. If you gentlemen come up, one in each corner. One on one side and one on the other. Dr. Richardson, do you favor restoring report cards that measure a child's progress by fixed standards at least as low as the fourth grade, or do you favor the usual educationalist gobbledygook as to why parents and teachers should not be so informed?
I've always spoken to that in our grading system in my community. By my urging, we do use A, B, C, D, and F, which are clearly accurate, I think. I had an argument some time ago with our professional administration when they wished to establish a grading system for the first two grades called OGSNU, O-G-S-N-U, Outstanding, Good, Not Achieving, Satisfactory. At any rate, I protested it. In answer to the question, I think my record will show what my position is.
Dr. Rafferty, is it true that you would throw out slobs and creeps from the schools and make gifted children wards of the state in specially selected homes?
That's sort of like have you stop beating your wife. You know? The answer is no, of course not.
For Dr. Richardson, are you a member of the ADA? If not, would you join?
I am not a member of the ADA. The second question I regard as impertinent.
Here's one just as impertinent. Dr. Rafferty, are you a member of the John Birch Society? If not, would you join?
I think the same man must have written both of those. The answer is no and no.
To both speakers, please state your views on indoctrination of students regarding communism and American values. Who wants to answer that?
I'll be happy to start.
We have to teach the children about isms. Communism is one of the unfortunate facts with which you're faced in the world today. I differ somewhat with my opponent in this approach, although I'm sure that he is as deeply concerned about this matter as I. But I feel that from the moment the child enters the school, if he has not been exposed to it first, he should be taught love of country. I submit that it is not enough to teach a logical and balanced and analytical view of Americanism or patriotism. Patriotism is love. That's all it is. And love, thank heaven, is not yet susceptible to the process of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. It springs unbidden from the deepest wellspring of the human being. It is an attribute unknown and unknowable of God Himself. And I think that there is a mighty important place in our schools for the teaching of love, in this case, love for a wonderful country. A first grader may be able to grasp the wonder and the glory of Washington kneeling in the snow and weeping at Valley Forge, whereas it may take a relatively mature senior high school understanding to understand the intricacies of the Monroe Doctrine. This means that there is room for both the emotional and the intellectual approach to the teaching of Americanism. We do not need special courses in it. We must have, as we do have in so many of our schools today, teachers who are warmly and firmly committed to love of country and who will exemplify it in their lives and actions as well as their lessons. What we really need in this state is a philosophy of education which preaches the importance of subject matter, not only in this major field, but in all others as well.
I wish each of you had the opportunity to read a newly adopted document in my home community called American Ideals and Institutions. It is the approach of our whole school system to our responsibility to instill in our children a profound love of this country and a basic understanding of its strengths, its greatness. I am glad to accept the word patriotism as a major function of the responsibilities of our schools. I would say this, gentlemen, that my own feelings of patriotism are built first, to be sure, upon a love of this nation, but also upon an overwhelming conviction, a function I would hope of my own intellectual ability to analyze, that we have in this nation something unique on earth, that we have a tradition of government by the people. And I want our students to understand the workings of the democratic process. I want them to know the problems, the issues of government in a free society. So I urge a patriotism which is built upon understanding and affection. Surely I want our children to be knowledgeable of the heroes of the past, to be knowledgeable of the moments of crises, the moments of greatness this nation has faced. But I want a patriotism built not alone upon looking backward, one built also upon looking around at the full panoply of greatness of this nation today, and a patriotism which impels a student as an adult to recognize his responsibility not only to preserve and protect and defend this nation, but also to seek to improve it. And in all of this, and in teaching our children about the face of the enemy, the ideology of communism which would destroy us, I repeat this, with the truth on our side, as I am deeply convinced that it is, our best tool is education, not indoctrination. And while my opponent may say indoctrination is an innocuous word, in his own language he has said that if indoctrination is ugly, if it's ugly to teach hate, then he has said, let's be ugly and let's revel in it. To me, this is not the approach to our school system. We have the truth on our side. We have our way of life. We have an enemy which, if understood, is surely rejected. I want a patriotism which is positive, functional, and dynamic, not one which is chauvinistic, not one which is begot of fear and arrogance.
This is for both speakers, and we'll let Dr. Richardson have the first go at this. Are you a proponent of the statements of Admiral Rickover?
In education or submarine building? I am not completely familiar with all of the statements that Admiral Rickover has made. I am more familiar with the statements and recommendations which have been made by Dr. James Bryant Conant, Distinguished Professor President Emeritus of Harvard University. And I am proud that I and my own community was able to lead a board action which mandated our staff to compare our school system with the recommendations made by Dr. Conant, and we have modified our entire curriculum. I think Admiral Rickover has served a vital function as being a critic of our education. We need our critics. I am proud that Dr. Joel Hildebrand, who is a distinguished critic of education, has supported my general approach. I can say only this. Admiral Rickover is right in many of his criticisms, but I still believe that he does not have full insight into all of the needs and all the responsibilities of education for all children in our society.
When I was initially honored by this invitation, which, as I said originally, was something which the average schoolman never gets, I was told in the instructions that personalities, personal attacks upon one's opponent, were not part of the Commonwealth Club agenda. I have avoided this today. I shall continue to avoid it. Admiral Rickover is a great man, no question about it, one of the outstanding geniuses of the day, and like many geniuses, he is somewhat prickly as a personality. His superiors have certainly found him to be so, in Washington. He has an unhappy faculty of being right about things. I do not join in Dr. Rickover's deep respect for Russian education. I think that Russian education is indeed indoctrination in virtually all of its phases. But I do feel this, that the very fact that an admiral, a non-educator, is forced to speak out and attain such a tremendously wide forum, such a group of millions of eager listeners in this country, when he speaks about a matter outside his proper scope and function, is indicative of the fact that we have a deep concern and a deep need for such criticism in this country. I prefer to have this criticism led by professionals, by trained educators and administrators. I feel that if this leadership had been forthcoming over the past decade and a half, Admiral Rickover would not have had to devote his attention to this sort of thing, which, after all, is outside his proper province. I think that he would be the first to agree. I would propose that insofar as one man can, and insofar as one great state is concerned, that conditions in California schools after next January the 1st will not give rise to the criticisms which the Admiral has felt compelled to invoke against American education in general.
This is to both speakers. How much influence on the local level does the state superintendent exert in formulating teaching policies and methods? And now we give Dr. Rafter the first go at this.
Thank you. A very great influence indeed. Progressive education came into California almost a generation ago from the top down, not from the bottom up. It came in as the result of disciples of John Dewey and his progressive education philosophy, spreading out from Columbia University Teachers College all over the country and taking positions of importance in our State Department of Education and in many of our county offices. They and their successors are still very much with us. I do not want to be misunderstood. Many of our State Department educators are from the finest people that I know. It will be my task to keep them working hard and constructively and under proper leadership for the first time in many years toward the betterment of education. But this sort of thing, I'm afraid, does exist. The influence on the local level, of course, is profound. In all of the utterances, all of the writings that emanate from the State Department and go to the local districts almost every week of the year, this type of philosophy permeates these directives. The State Department is instrumental in establishing the curriculum for the schools, in selecting and imprinting the textbooks which the children use, in setting the requirements for the credentials of the teachers who must teach in the classrooms. In all of these areas, the State Department of Education is virtually supreme. The State Superintendent of Public Instruction needs to institute a new climate, a new way of thinking about things, a new philosophy of education. I propose, gentlemen, not an attack upon individuals, but an attack upon an ism, a thing, a way of thinking about life, an anti-intellectualism in high places. When this is done, the situation in the local districts in its own good time will amply remedy itself.
I would hope that in the exigencies and the tensions of a campaign that no impression is created that either candidate is attacking the other. I do, of course, take positions of difference with respect to my opponent, and in order to draw attention to those differences, I am on occasion obliged to quote his language. This is the only issue. With respect to the role of the Superintendent of Public Instruction, I repeat that he is in a position of leadership. He must be the public voice of ideas and ideals in education. He is relatively limited and circumscribed in terms of the absolute or ex cathedra power that he has to push buttons and to declare or decree what shall be done locally. I think we can best judge this issue now by looking at the past. I supported and carry today battle scars among certain professional groups because I did support it, the Fisher Bill. Senate Bill 57 was a major strengthening in the preparation and training of teachers. It now demands a major focus in the preparation of teachers upon content and academic disciplines, and has tended to reduce the coursework requirement in methodology. I believe the bill was good. I testified in its behalf. I developed testimony from other people in the field of education. It is, I think, a constructive field move forward. Again, I suggest to you, gentlemen, the issue is not whether each one of us can campaign more eloquently against the ghost of John Dewey. The real issue here is our own background, and again, I point out what has been achieved in my own district. I am not, I will not accept the label of the apologist of a status quo. I am demanding change, but I ask that that change be made basically in confidence of the value of our educational system and basically in confidence of people in educational leadership. I cannot detect some overwhelming plot by which there has, by devious design, been some effort to destroy the values of education in this society. I cannot see how a plot would apply in the field of or profession of education without saying that there must be a plot among all professions. Can you assume that among doctors there has been some devious design, some bad theory of medicine intentionally promulgated? Can you assume that among lawyers there has been some devious design? There is no plot in education. Our problem is to improve. Our problem is to change. Our problem is to strengthen. And in all this, I think it can be done with confidence in our schools and confidence in our teachers in a constructive manner.
Well, Mr. Hosmer, see me at this desk. There's a long-distance phone call from Los Angeles. Commonwealth Club of California appreciates very much the appearance of you two gentlemen from south of the Tehachapi, Dr. Ralph Richardson and Dr. Maxwell Rafferty, of the candidates for our State Superintendent of Public Instruction. We have many members in the Los Angeles area, and after listening to both of you, we'd like very much to have the two as you as members of this club. This meeting now stands adjourned.
This is Stuart Richardson Ward, and across the table from me sits at the microphone Dr. Ralph Richardson, former president of the Los Angeles Board of Education, and also Dr. Maxwell Rafferty, superintendent of schools at La Cañada, California, who spoke before the weekly general meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California here in the Sheraton Palace Hotel in San Francisco. And as the topics of these two gentlemen who debated each other were the real issues as to California schools. Gentlemen, supposing we take up one of the first points that was raised, and this was as to whether or not the schools are now teaching life adjustment in contrast to the subject matter. In other words, teaching preparation for life and getting along rather than with the matter of learning special subjects, and whether or not this is good or bad. Who wants to open on that?
I'd like to open.
All right, I recognize first, then, Dr. Maxwell Rafferty.
I wanted to say principally that I'm going to have to do justice to my opponent here. He is an ex-president of the Los Angeles City School Board, and I'm the ex-superintendent at La Cañada. I resigned earlier this year in order to run for this office.
We'll put two X's on the manuscript.
Fine.
Thank you.
Life Adjustment Program is, of course, still very much our state philosophy of education in California. It has been slightly amended of late in view of an aroused and angry public opinion. However, it still exists on the state level. It permeates many of our local schools that are the prisoners, virtually, of the directives and the consultative media of the State Department of Education. What is needed, of course, is a change in intellectual climate, a change in the way of looking at things philosophically in regard to education. We need to recognize and to admit and to boast that the schools exist primarily to teach subject matter, organized, systematic, and disciplined subject matter, and that adjustment to one's peer group, adjustment to one's environment, and socializings and sharings are byproducts of this, not the main goals of education.
Thank you, Dr. Maxwell Rafferty. Now, Dr. Ralph Richardson, would you like to comment?
Indeed, I do. I am no apologist and no defender of softness in progressive education. I hold that that life adjustment is best which is predicated upon an intensive, disciplined education where achievement is the goal. Achievement in the field of the three R's. I would point out that in my home community of Los Angeles, we have been able to move the whole pendulum of philosophy back to a stronger focus upon basic and fundamental disciplines. I am convinced that we have a responsibility to teach our children to read, to write, and to spell, and also to think accurately, to reason clearly. I believe all of us will agree that the pendulum of philosophy is swinging toward a return to the focus upon the fundamentals. With this direction of swing, I am in complete agreement and have supported it. This is not an issue here.
Thank you, gentlemen. And now, let's take the question up as to who should control the California schools, whether there is, in the judgment of either or both of you, a trend towards great control by the district, by the state, and by the federal departments of education, rather than by the parents. Who wants to open on that? Dr. Richardson? Go ahead.
As I have been campaigning statewide, I have observed among the profession of education in the local districts considerable sensitivity, indeed apprehension, about recent items of legislation, which is felt by many to have been an invasion of the responsibilities of a local district. The solution here, as I see it, is not to rail at the legislature, because, after all, the legislature is the legally constituted voice of the people of California. And under our Constitution, education is a state responsibility. The legislature has wisely delegated to its own creatures, local districts, the responsibility for carrying out the state educational program. I believe the solution is to have a superintendent of public instruction who can win the confidence and the ear of the legislature and can counsel the legislature against the adoption of measures which would be deleterious in their effect upon local control. Basic to our whole system is the variety, the experimental approach of each district. Necessary state standards must be maintained in teacher certification and length of school year, but the heart of our system is the intense creativity of the local district, and that I support.
Same question to Dr. Maxwell Rafferty. Who should control the schools, the district, the state, the federal departments of education, or the parents?
Traditional function of the state is research, leadership, and service. Control has always been left to the local districts until very recently. It is not sufficient to do, as my opponent has said, simply to pay lip service to the principle of local control. What is needed is a state superintendent who, in addition to working with the legislature, will lead a positive and an aggressive attack upon this trend toward statism. We cannot solve this problem by simply sitting by in the State Department of Education and uttering pious platitudes. What we need is a superintendent who is aggressive, who has the leadership function of going over to the floor of the legislature, buttonholing legislators, and engaging in an active and a positive campaign to reverse this present trend toward statism. This sort of thing I pledge to do if I am elected in November.
Dr. Rafferty raised the point that he felt that there were sanctions being exercised against the Southern California School District because they had the school board had not allowed the teachers a free hand, and therefore the state educational system of teachers were threatening sanctions. Would you like to speak on that, Dr. Richardson?
You must understand what has happened here. My study of what occurred in the particular district persuaded me that personnel practices, invasions of the classroom by board members occurred such that there was a need to have public attention drawn to the errors of the local district. Sanctions have no impact other than that they are a publicly voiced criticism of the practices of a school system. If there were an invasion of the actual prerogatives of a school district, then I would suggest there is a need for remedial legislation. I am convinced that in this case to which we have referred, that the decision of the Superior Court of the County of Los Angeles was correct when it said that the agency bringing the sanctions or making the public criticism was completely within its right. There is no problem here.
All right. Well, what would you say as a rejoinder, Dr. Maxwell Rafferty?
Well, I would differ. There is a great problem here. Sanctions may be legal, but they're completely immoral. Sanctions are directed against the children. This is the way it works out anyway, although the Teachers Association may certainly not intend this. But sanctions are boycotts. The Teachers Association simply urged all of its teachers to quit and then refused to supply any new ones from its placement bureau. The only result of this would be, of course, the children would go teacherless. And this is the very reverse and prostitution of what we as teachers are supposed to be doing, that is, helping children. The remedy lies within the district, not in some outside privately controlled organization coming in and attempting to interfere with local prerogatives. If the system is bad, the local taxpayers and voters will correct it. After all, it is their children who are involved in this thing. The teachers simply work there. And while teachers have their rights, which should absolutely be safeguarded, I am one of them, and I have been one for 22 years. Still, the local control of a district is democratically in the hands of the legally constituted school board. And to interfere with this right seems to me to be set a very dangerous precedent.
Go ahead, Dr.
Even when the board is engaging in practices which are harmful to the education of the children?
The board is the creature of the public. The children belong to the public, and the public have the right every 2 years to change the board. This certainly seems to me to lie within the proper remedy of the local voters.
Are not sanctions but a means of public criticism which can lead toward better education?
No, sir. Sanctions are a way of invoking this particular boycott which affects the lives and the educational destinies of the children. As such, I oppose anything which would interfere with the education of the children.
Would you say teachers are compelled to work in a district by your standards?
Certainly not. Any individual teacher can quit any time he wants to, and I have done so myself, but this is far different from leading an organized boycott against a legally constituted school board.
Next point.
All right. Good. Now, gentlemen, would you like to briefly go over a number of points, because we have thousands of fathers and mothers all the way from the Mexican border up to Oregon and in Oregon itself listening to this program. Would
Some
you briefly?
Voters outside the state?
Yes, indeed. But you should be like Senator Wayne Moss, who campaigns when he's in San Francisco as though it was his district. Briefly, how do each of you stand with respect to the grading? You all know what the issues are. Our listeners know. Whether or not you shall have a grading which says satisfactory for this child or something of that sort rather than A, B, C, D. How do you stand on Dr. Rafferty?
I stand for A, B, C, D, and F grading. I stand for competitive grading on all levels, and I feel that the sooner the children learn that competition is an important fact of American life, the better off we'll be and the more definitely we will be teaching adjustment to their lives.
And Dr. Ralph Richardson, please.
I support and have worked for and now have established in my home district an A, B, C, D, and F grading system. I recognize indeed the value of competition in education. I would, however, urge that we consider this, that for some children, especially in the beginning of their education, they do need encouragement, they need a sense of achievement, which cannot always be demonstrated to them if we look at their level of mental ability in a purely competitive context. Education has the responsibility to take each child at his level of ability and to bring him along, not to discourage him at the very first day in school.
I'd certainly agree with this, too.
All right. Now, on one of the most basic questions, I think, gentlemen, which you two men discussed so ably before the Commonwealth Club of California just now, and that is we get down to the basis of motivation. Sir John Adams, back in 1920, I heard talk at UCLA, and I've never forgotten, maintaining that we're governed by our, not by our intellect, but by our emotions. And you raised that question and discussed it. So do you feel that patriotism is something should be taught as an emotional thing or simply as a political and intellectual analysis, if you will accept those words? Who wants to open on that, Dr. Richardson? Go ahead.
Yes. May I ask, when you say you heard this at UCLA, are you a UCLA man?
2 years there and 2 years Berkeley.
Well, I point out that my identity as a UCLA professor is some reason for you to have possible interest in my candidacy.
And mine as a UCLA alumnus.
Remember, we are in Northern California now.
That's true. Well, as an ex-debater at those institutions, I have the privilege of facing you across this microphone every week. All right, go ahead. And now you come in on this, Dr. Rafferty. How do you feel? Did you finish, Dr. Richardson?
Oh,
go ahead.
Indeed not.
Go ahead.
I believe that one of the overwhelming responsibilities of our public schools in California is to instill in our children a deep and profound commitment to this nation, a love of it, and a sense of responsibility to improve and protect and defend it. I would say this, that patriotism is best, which is built both upon affection and understanding. I love this nation not only because I live here, but because I understand it and know that we have something unique on this earth, a free way of life where the individual dignity of man is respected. And I think that we have a responsibility to teach our children the very heart, the very essence of our way of life, and that in all of this, our best approach is education. I am convinced that we have on our side in the great moral issues of the world the truth, and I believe that the truth explained is fully revered and adopted by our students.
Thank you, Dr. Richardson. And now, Dr. Rafferty.
Education and patriotism and Americanism have this much in common, especially in the two latter. Patriotism is love. That's all it is. It is not susceptible to a logical analysis, particularly at an early stage of child development. The child should be taught to love his country just as he loves his mother and his father, and for the same reasons. I believe that in the later stages, if a child has been taught to love his country and to have affection for a wonderful land, he will then have sufficient interest and motivation to learn to understand the complexities and the intricacies of our great past, and then to understand her faults as well as her virtues. I think that without that vital ingredient of love, which in many cases, alas, today is missing, that children will not have the motivation to get this later understanding.
Gentlemen, I think you bring out a point. Let's press it one step further. Do you feel, each of you, that the parents have a right, as the taxpayers for the schools and the parents of the children, do they have a right to indoctrinate and to press upon the children at a very early and tender age their convictions with respect to not only religion but such things as patriotism and education. Is that a proper right for the parents to try to exercise through the schools? What do you think, Dr. Rafferty?
Most of home instruction, of course, is indoctrination. When you teach a child to take off his hat in the presence of ladies, when you teach him to rise when a lady comes into the room, this is nothing but indoctrination. The child is too young to understand the reason. Similarly, when we lead him to the flag and teach him to revere it and to love it, this is a type of indoctrination. But according to Webster's Dictionary, indoctrination is imbuing or teaching or educating in its finest sense. In this particular definition, not in its less desirable modern connotation, indoctrination can be a very wonderful thing.
Dr. Richardson, do you agree?
Would you restate your question? I'm not...
Do you feel that parents have a right, as the taxpayers and as the parents of the children, to indoctrinate and by emotions lead children to adhere to what the parents believe is in such matters, not only in religion, but as a matter of patriotism and that sort of thing?
Indeed, they have the right. The basic unit of our society is the home, and sacred within that institution is the relationship between parent and child. I would say they surely have the right to instill in each child such beliefs as the parents believe are best for the child. I would further add that not only do they have this right, parents have a responsibility. They attempt on many an occasion to assign to the schools all the responsibilities for education. There must be in each home of California, if we could but achieve it, a respect for learning, a respect for the values of education, which the home supports. If the schools could assign to the home as much responsibility as the home wishes to assign to the schools, education in California might be less popular but far more successful.
All right. Gentlemen, would you like to make just a brief sentence, and that's all we have time for? How much influence do you feel the State Department of Education should have on the children? And your office, which you seek. Go ahead.
The State Department of Education should influence profoundly education in this state. That is its function. It should not control local education.
And Dr. Richardson?
It is an office of leadership, an office of research, and I would bring to it the support that I have statewide dedicated to the idea that education and excellence is our responsibility.
Thank you, and next week, same station, same time, I'll be interviewing for you the Commonwealth Club of California Speaker, His Excellency Barack Kumar Nehru, India's Ambassador to the United States.